Somewhere in the early 1600s, a man who could not see sat down to write what he believed would be the greatest poem in human history. He said it would include, in his words, things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. It's the view of the modern world that he achieved exactly what he set out to achieve. His poem, Paradise Lost, is considered the greatest epic poem in the English language. Few poems take on such an enormous theme as Paradise Lost, a theme that's nothing less than the origin of evil itself. The man who took on this enormous and ambitious theme, and created a classic in the process, is a man who led a life of immense struggle, loss, and sacrifice. In a sense, John Milton's life itself was a search for paradise, a life in which the poet became the poem. He was born in London on December 9th, 1608, not far from the Mermaid Tavern, where Shakespeare and his circle of friends used to gather. He was 8 when Shakespeare died, though it's not known whether he ever caught a glimpse of the famous playwright. John Milton was born into a devout and very cultured Puritan family. His father was a scrivener, someone who records property deeds and titles. Mr. Milton was also a talented musician and composer, who had some fame among his contemporaries. Perhaps because he was an artist himself, he recognized his son's exceptional gifts and provided him with an excellent education and lots of moral and financial support. Milton's father ordained from childhood that his son would study the humanities, and the child took to these studies with such a passion that from the time he was 12, he read every day until midnight. Milton believed these early study sessions were what first damaged his eyes, which were naturally weak, and gave him many headaches. These handicaps didn't check his eagerness to learn, however, and his father, in addition to the regular schoolwork, saw to it that he received daily instruction at home by the greatest scholars in London. After he'd been instructed in 5 languages and had a strong foundation in philosophy, Milton was sent to Cambridge to study for the church. There, because of his youthful and fair appearance and his refined manners, he earned the nickname the Lady of Christ's College. The year he graduated from Cambridge when he was 21 was the same year Milton wrote his first famous poem, a Christmas ode entitled On the Morning of Christ's Nativity. He also wrote 2 companion poems called The Cheerful Man and The Pensive Man, which contrast innocent pleasure-seeking with pursuits that are serious and thoughtful. When he was only 24, Milton retired through the graces of his indulgent father. He went to the family estate in the country to continue his studies, and it was there that the muse of poetry came to him. As a devoutly religious man, Milton believed that one was called to one's vocation, and his calling was poetry. He gave up the idea of a career in the church, which he felt had been invaded by tyranny, and dedicated himself to serving God through rhyme. He wrote sonnets and poems to Shakespeare on nature, on passion, and on time, which he called that subtle thief of youth. For 6 years he stayed in the country, pursuing his writing and reading, preparing himself to be a great poet. Towards the end of his stay in the country, he wrote, considered by many to be the finest short poem in the English language. It was a tribute to a friend who had drowned in the Irish Sea. Milton then made the poet's pilgrimage to Grand Italy, and there he met the greatest writers and scientists of his time, including Galileo. Galileo was blind by then and under house arrest, but Milton couldn't have known that both those fates would soon be his own. In Italy, amid the radiance of Florence, Venice, Milan, and Rome, John Milton was awakened to his destiny. He dedicated himself to what he believed was the highest form of poetry, the only art that could express God's inexpressible beauty, the epic poem. He said, "For though I did not know what else God may have decreed for me, this certainly was true. He had instilled into me a vehement love of the beautiful. Not so diligently is Ceres said to have sought her daughter Proserpina, as I sought for this idea of the beautiful. Throughout all of the shapes and forms of things did I search. Day and night I searched and followed its lead eagerly, as if by certain clear traces. When it happened that I found anywhere one who, despising the warped judgment of the public, dared to feel and speak and be that which the greatest wisdom throughout all ages has taught to be best, I would cling to him immediately from a kind of necessity. You ask what I was thinking of. So help me God and immortality of fame. What was I doing? Growing my wings and practicing flight. But my Pegasus still rose himself on very tender wings." By now, Milton had decided on a subject for his epic poem. It would be about King Arthur. He would glorify England as Virgil had glorified Rome. But when Milton returned to England, he responded to a very different call, the call of politics, and he abandoned his epic. He had returned when rumors of war in England cropped up, and he arrived back in 1639 at the beginning of the Puritan Revolution. During all these years, Milton had been supported by his father, but now both felt it was time he had earned his own living. He established himself in London as a schoolmaster, and soon became involved in the fiery religious debates of the day. He supported the Puritan Party, which wished to reform the Church of England, and he wrote several pamphlets advocating his party's position. Now, too, he became obsessed with the vision of a social utopia, a free England. He felt it was his patriotic duty to help establish a Puritan commonwealth. With zeal, he took up the parliamentary cause against the king and the bishops. He wrote vigorous pamphlets denouncing the rituals of the church and the oppression of the monarchy. He began to plan his great poem, but politics gave him no time to write. Milton was full of promise and hope. He saw a worldly paradise, a paradise of civil and religious liberty. He expected nothing less than the regeneration of the English people. Swept by this emotion of hope and renewal, he married for the first time to a woman named Mary Powell. It was to be the fulfillment of his highest ideal, love as the expression of harmony between body and spirit. He described his longing this way: this pure and inbred desire of joining to itself in conjugal fellowship a fit conversing soul, which desire is properly called love, is stronger than death. Many waters cannot quench it, neither can the floods drown it. As his countrymen joined hands to fight what they called the good cause, so would Milton and his wife join their souls and greet this paradise as one, as he wrote of Adam and Eve years later in Paradise Lost. The world was all before them, were to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. But Eden would prove elusive to Milton. He was a strong Puritan opposed to royalty, and his wife Mary was a member of a royalist family. She was accustomed to a large, cheerful household, and Milton was serious and introspective. Soon she went to visit her family. The visit lasted 3 years. Milton's ideal of conjugal bliss lay shattered. He found himself in horror of the idea of being chained for life to someone he didn't love. So he began to understand and write doctrines about divorce. Milton's writings were seen as an assault upon the sacredness of marriage, and he was scorned by his critics and condemned by the church. He responded by saying, "Wherein can God delight, wherein be worshipped, wherein be glorified, by the forcible continuing of an improper and ill-yoking couple? He that loved not to see the disparity of several cattle at the plow couldn't be pleased with a vast disharmony in marriage. Surely Christ could not have meant to cut off all remedy from a good man who finds himself consuming away in a disconsolate and unjoined matrimony." Milton's paradise had been the unity of two souls, but this paradise had escaped him. He maintained that his very idealism about marriage had caused him to suffer more than most in his failed marriage. For, he said, no man knows hell like him who converses most in heaven. Around this time, Milton published his first volume of poems, which included two of his greatest works, Comus and Lycidas. As Milton's marriage ruptured, so did his country. Civil war broke out in England. At the same time, his eyesight began to fail, and he was plagued by headaches. He reunited with Mary, and in trying to save their marriage, they had their first child, a daughter. She was born crippled. In 1649, King Charles was beheaded, with Milton's blessings. He hadn't thought it a very enlightened head. Milton became the foreign secretary to Oliver Cromwell, a leader in the new Commonwealth. He became even more impassioned by the cause of the Republic. He believed that in a world of good and evil, man must exercise the power of moral choice, and in his new position, he saw the opportunity to make those choices. He said, "I cannot praise a fugitive and cloistered virtue, unexercised and unbreathed, that never sallies out and sees her adversary, but slinks out of the race where that immortal garland is to be run for, not without dust and heat." Milton had no vision of love left. but he had a large and thrilling vision of a new era in England. His skills were spent on pamphlets and prose works. He wrote treatises on behalf of freedom of the press, on theology, on government, on education. He felt the ultimate goal of education was to unite humanity with God. The goal of man's education is to repair the ruins of our first parents by regaining to know God aright, and out of that knowledge to love Him, to imitate Him, to be like Him, as we may the nearest by possessing our souls of true virtue, which, being united to the heavenly grace of faith, makes up the highest perfection. Milton's curriculum was based on the Bible and on the ancient classics, but it also included science. In religion, he worked towards an ultimate Protestantism, in which individuals could be their own church. The only doctrine needed was the Bible. Each Christian, under the guidance of the Spirit, might meet God directly. But to Milton, it seemed his audience had little interest in meeting God directly. He became an enemy of the church and the target of attacks from all sides. The Parliament, even Cromwell, turned deaf ears to his words. By then, Milton's left eye was blind, the right eye failing. He began to fear his blindness, and a terrible question occurred to him. What if his entry into heaven depended on how well he had used the gifts God had given him? And how was he to use that gift, the gift of poetry, if he were blind? This question inspired one of his most moving sonnets, When I Consider, written in 1655, when he was 47 years old. At the end of the poem, Milton accepts that what God wants of him is only obedience. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide. Doth God exact day labor, light denied? I fondly ask. But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies. God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. Life with Mary had settled into a peaceful understanding, and the Miltons had built a family. When he was 42, this too was shattered. Mary died giving birth to their third daughter. The following month, his only son, John, died at the age of one. In the same 42nd year that his wife and son died, Milton became totally blind. With deep melancholy, he confronted the deprivation of seeing the beauty of God's world. And yet within the melancholy was hope. Could it be his fate that another, more transcendent sight might replace what he had lost? Thus with the year seasons return, but not to me returns day, or the sweet approach of even or morn, or sight of vernal bloom or summer's rose, or flocks or herds or human face divine, but cloud instead, and ever-during dark surrounds me from the cheerful ways of men, cut off and for the book of knowledge fair, presented with a universal blank of nature's works to me expunged and raised, and wisdom at one entrance quite shut out. So much the rather thou, celestial light, shine inward, and the mind, through all her powers, irradiate their plant eyes, all mist from thence, purge and disperse, that I may see and tell of things invisible to mortal sight. 4 years later, Milton remarried, this time to the true love of his life, Catherine Woodcock. At last he thought he'd found his conjugal paradise, a marriage of true and deepest love, a harmony of minds and soul. But his paradise was fleeting. Only a year later, Catherine too died in childbirth, and a month after that, their infant child followed her to the grave. When Catherine died, Milton wrote one of his most beautiful sonnets, entitled On His Deceased Wife. Methought I saw my lace-espoused saint brought to me, like Alcestis from the grave, whom Jove's great son to her glad husband gave, rescued from death by force through pale and faint, mine as whom washed from spot of childbed taint, purification in the old law did save, and such, as yet once more I trust to have, full sight of her in heaven without restraint, come vested all in white, pure as her mind, her face was veiled, yet to my fancied sight, Love, sweetness, goodness in her person shined, so clear as in no face with more delight. But oh, as to embrace me she inclined, I'd waked, she fled, and day brought back my night. The paradise of blissful marriage, the paradise of a free church, the paradise of a liberated England, all had been lost. It was Milton's moment of surrender, but he didn't surrender to despair. He chose instead to surrender to God's will. He resolved at last to avenge himself, not with bitterness, but with a record of his own transcendent ideal. He began at last to write his glorious epic. He said, "There was now only an inward prompting that grew daily upon me, that by labor and in study, which I take to be my portion in life, joined with the strong propensity of nature, I perhaps leave something so written to after times as they should not willingly let it die." But now he no longer chose to dedicate his epic to King Arthur. He asked, "Why glorify a nation when I can glorify God?" For his new subject, Milton chose the most basic story of humanity, Genesis. He set out with a conscious goal to create the world's greatest poem. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed, in the beginning how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos, or of Sion Hill, delight thee more, in Siloah's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke they aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Anonian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme." As Milton wrote, Cromwell died, and a king once more took the throne of England. With the coronation of Charles II, the good old cause was finally lost, and yet to Milton the loss had been suffered long before. The paradise of liberty and freedom was not to be found on earth. So be it. The new cause would be liberty, not of the body, but of the soul. Thus much I should perhaps have said, though I were sure I should have spoken only to trees and stones, and had none to cry to but with the prophet, O earth, 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 to tell the very soil itself what her perverse inhabitants are deaf to. But I trust I shall have spoken persuasion to some, perhaps, whom God may raise of these stones to become children of reviving liberty. The restoration of the monarchy forced Milton into hiding, but he was found, arrested, and imprisoned. A royalist spoke in his defense and said, I shall leave him under the rod of correction. Herewith God hath already evidenced his particular judgment by striking Milton blind. Milton saw differently. He believed God had judged him blind before he lost his sight, and now sought to bring him true sight by incurring blindness. Upon his release from prison, Milton lost all that remained to him, his wealth, his position, his hopes. He had already learned that the Commonwealth was not the utopia he had sought. But in restoring the monarchy to the throne, he felt his people had turned their backs on freedom. The new monarchy stood for all he had fought against his entire life. He was an exile from his own people. Lonely and helpless, in 1663, Milton married for the third and last time to Elizabeth Minshull. It was a marriage of convenience. He'd been blind for 11 years and needed someone to run the household and look after his 3 daughters. But it was also a comfortable marriage. Elizabeth was his companion, a helpmate in his work. With her assistance, he once again took up his epic. He composed each segment in his mind, memorized it, then dictated it to his secretary. He declared he would triumph over his blindness, even though it had been the means to his glorious end, his epic of God. These 3 years, these eyes, through clear to outward view of blemish or of spot, bereft of light their seeing have forgot, nor to their idle orbs doth sight appear, of sun or moon or star throughout the year, or man or woman. Yet I argue not against heaven's hand or will, nor bate a jot of heart or hope, but still bear up and steer right onward. As he rode on, fire raged through the streets of London. The great fire of 1663 destroyed Milton's house, all that he had left. It was followed by the plague, and he retreated to the country again, where the muse of poetry had first possessed him. There in the country, the prophet who had failed, the man of the Lord to whom no one listened to, the disillusioned fighter for freedom, completed his great work. In 1667, when Milton was 59, Paradise Lost was finally released, to the interest and acclaim of none. It was 10 books long. It had taken 10 years to write, and he was paid £10 for it. None of this discouraged him. Paradise Lost was quickly followed by two other great works, Paradise Regained and Samson Agonistes. Then began the quiet years. Milton continued to write, although the excruciating pain of gout weakened him. When it was most painful, he played the organ and sang hymns, which he said kept him cheerful. He couldn't see, but he knew how he appeared, hands gnarled and calloused from gout. Neat black clothes, unable to disguise a pale, thin figure, a hobbling, stiff gait, and vacant, useless eyes. The Lady of Christ's Church had become an old man, in whom the Maker only could find beauty, beauty not the least found in resignation. He wrote, "Henceforth I learn that to obey is best, and love with fear the only God, to walk as in His presence, ever to observe His providence, and on Him soul depend. Merciful over all his works, with good still overcoming evil, and by small accomplishing great things, by things deemed weak, subverting worldly strong, and worldly wise by simply meek, that suffering for truth's sake is fortitude to highest victory, and to the faithful death the gate of life, taught this by his example, whom I now acknowledge my Redeemer, ever blessed." Life took on a routine. Milton rose at 4 a.m., and at 4:30 he was read to from the Bible. Then he meditated. At 7 he was read to again. Then he wrote until dinner. After dinner he walked for 3 to 4 hours. In the evenings he was read poetry to refresh himself from the day's labors. The poems he held most in esteem were the Psalms of David. He was in bed by 9. At bedtime he had a glass of water and a pipe. He didn't attend church. He didn't pray. His studies and meditations were his habitual prayer. In summer, the creative stream was always dry. His inspiration never flowed except from the autumnal equinox to the spring, and whatever he attempted to do at other times was never to his satisfaction. John Milton died on November 8, 1674, at the age of 66, probably from complications of gout. He died with little recognition of his genius, and with almost no material or earthly reward. But the epic had been written, and the aims had been met. Milton had once written, "Art is most eloquent, which returns and approaches nearest to nature from whence it came, so that how he should be truly eloquent, who is not withal a godly man, I see not. And long it was not after when I was confirmed in this opinion, that he would not be frustrated in his hopes to write well in laudable things, ought himself to be a true poem. That is, a composition and pattern of the best and honorablest things, not presuming to sing high praises of heroic men or famous cities, unless he have in himself the experience and the practice of all that which is praiseworthy. Then it is, as has been aspired in my life, that the poet becomes the poem." This poem that the poet became, Paradise Lost, has become one of the great classics of English literature. No one knows exactly when Milton began his masterpiece, but he planned it as early as 1640 when he was 32 years old. After he received an initial payment of £5 for Paradise Lost, he received an additional payment of £5 on the sale of the first 3 editions. His widow later settled all claim of publication for £8. In total, £18 were paid for a work that took nearly a decade to write and became the world's most famous and inspired epic poem. The definition of an epic poem is simply a narrative poem of considerable length, which tells a story of great importance. Its subject is grand, and its theme has meaning to all people, in all times. The style of an epic is also elaborate, and should make the reader feel awe. It should match in grandeur its subject. In these attributes, Paradise Lost is the consummate epic poem. The entire 10 books of the poem, later revised to 12 books, recount what takes up only a few verses in Genesis. It covers the rebellion of the angels, the war in heaven, the creation, the fall, and the history of humanity up until the birth, death, and resurrection of Christ. Milton believed evil is embedded in man's nature as a result of the original sin in the Garden of Eden, and the sins of the descendants of Adam and Eve, who are our common ancestors. Readers have always found his portrait of Satan to be one of the most fascinating aspects of the poem. Satan is almost a sympathetic character, complex, and at times unsure, with inner struggles familiar to all of us. Adam and Eve are also given depth. They're allowed to grow, learn, and become transformed by their experiences in a way that makes them far more real and human. At the end of Paradise Lost, paradise has been lost, but there is the promise that it will be refound. And in that promise, Milton has fulfilled the obligation to find for himself at the beginning of the poem, to justify the ways of God to men. His attitude after the fall of Adam and Eve is hopeful and even celebratory at times. That happiness comes from his conviction that, if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, Christ would never have been born. Not only that, but the fall gave man the opportunity to better himself. Innocence is a virtue, but the humility and shame that comes with sinning opens the way to far greater virtues, tolerance, compassion, and understanding. These virtues are almost impossible for innocence to attain, because they have no way of understanding suffering or people's weaknesses. By the end of the poem, Adam and Eve have left their innocence behind, but they have gained wisdom. They know that peace and happiness depend on their inner selves, not their environment. They also know that there are many things they can't comprehend, and that their time is better spent in obedience and devotion than in trying to unravel the mysteries of God and His universe. This is why their fall is ultimately a happy fall. Their own consciousness has been broadened, and the life of Christ will make possible an even higher life for man than Adam and Eve's innocence could ever have achieved. This is the inspiring message that emerges from the beautifully elaborate language and the arresting story of Paradise Lost. It is perhaps not a new message, and it is certainly not a new story, but its message and a story freshly presented and eloquently conveyed. In his exquisite masterpiece, Milton also asked for God's aid in helping him to turn his blindness to good. He prays to be granted sight that is superior to the physical sight he has lost, spiritual sight that reveals the ultimate truths. To the thousands of people over 4 centuries who have admired and been inspired by Paradise Lost, it is a wish that seemed to have been granted.
This is the end of the session.